Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Today, it's a conversation about some unsung heroes. My guest is Dr. Keisha Blaine, a historian and Africana studies professor at Brown University, whose latest book chronicles the groundbreaking work of Black women in advancing civil and human rights. While some of the names of these women are familiar, many have been lost to history, despite the importance of their work and the accomplishments that they achieved in the face of significant opposition and barriers. The book is called Without Fear, Black Women and the Making of Human Rights. Dr. Keisha Blaine joins me here in Studio A. Dr. Blaine, it's great to meet you. Welcome to Baltimore and welcome to WIPR.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So let's talk about the distinction, if you see one, between what we refer to as civil rights and human rights, because this is a thread that goes through the whole book.
Yes, this is something that I really try to pull through this text because my previous book was actually on civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer. And one of the things that I grappled with in writing that book is just trying to explain the way that she made demands of the federal government, largely because she made an argument that Black people needed to have certain rights and opportunities simply because they are citizens of the United States. And so when we talk about civil rights, we are very much thinking about the relationship between the citizen and the state. We're thinking about rights that are protected, for example, by the Constitution. And that is certainly part of the history that I tell in this book, but it's even more than that. It's taking a step back and grappling with rights that ultimately are tied to humanity. We're talking about God-given protections that each person should have regardless of their citizenship status, that each person should have regardless of where they happen to be located in the world. And so I emphasize three core, I think, tenets in this book. It's one, universal rights, which certainly apply everywhere. Equal rights, which emphasize that there are certain protections that really should apply to every single person, and then to natural rights, which is to say that there are certain inherent protections and rights that we should all have simply because we are human. So it is about moving beyond the physical borders of the United States and thinking about making a demand that goes far beyond the Constitution, even as it's certainly important. But these women who I emphasize in this book are thinking not solely about the relationship between Black people and the federal government or the state, but they are thinking about the fact that they should be treated a certain way simply because they are human.
And as you define human rights, these are rights that accrue to people not because of the state, but
exactly.
Really, you say they come from God.
Yes. Yes. I think many of the women in the book really do emphasize this aspect. Of course, I talk about women from diverse backgrounds. Some are far more religious than others, but there is a general sense that these are God-given, and because they are God-given, no man can essentially take them away. And it is, I think, a particular argument that they push in order to, in some ways, elevate their claims and really, I think, in some ways, elevate the argument. And what I mean by that is they're able to shame the United States on a global scale because they're able to say the way Black people are being treated in the United States, it's not just a violation of their civil rights. Actually, they are being mistreated and they're being treated as less than human. And in framing it that way, that there is a hope certainly among these women that it will bring greater attention to their concerns. And then they're able to forge transnational alliances with others who share their views living in diverse parts of the world.
Yeah, well, one of the things that was interesting to me about these profiles of all these different women, and there are dozens and dozens. I didn't count, but did you count? How many you actually?
I did not count, but I do cover
it's
many.
It's a lot. Is the sort of automatic connection between civil rights and human rights. So it was And it's something I hadn't thought of when I thought of the, you know, civil rights movement. I mean, you talk about Diane Nash, for example, or Shirley Chisholm, or something, who tied the fight for civil rights in the United States, voting rights, et cetera, in the 1960s with Dr. King and the movement to global human rights. It was always tied globally.
Always. And I think that particular aspect of the story has not been emphasized as much in the scholarship as it should be. And that's part of why I wanted to write this book, because it is true that activists and intellectuals were thinking about what was taking place in the United States. They certainly did participate in these conversations and these efforts to expand voting rights, as one example. They recognized the importance of the vote, and then they understood how that was very much tied to a conversation of rights of a citizen of the United States. But what is so important, I think, about these women is that they didn't simply stay there. They were able to, I think, grapple with these concerns at multiple levels. And they recognized that the challenges they were facing on U.S. soil could really not be divorced from what was taking place globally, which is to say that if you're talking about Jim Crow in the context of the U.S. South, then you also have to grapple with colonialism on the African continent. As just one example, I think these women were very sharp thinkers, and they were mindful that the challenges that they were facing were not solely unique to the United States, even as we can certainly talk about the context of the nation. But they recognize that there was a way that it was important to connect what was happening in their communities, what was happening on a national level, to what was happening all over the world, essentially. And as I point out in the book, they were making these connections so many decades before the modern civil rights movement that we talk about in the context of the 1950s and 60s.
If you've just joined us, it's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today, Dr. Keisha Blaine. She's an historian and an Africana studies professor at Brown University up in Providence, Rhode Island. And we're talking about her latest book, Without Fear, Black Women and the Making of Human Rights. So, Dr. Blaine, there are any number of women I'd never heard of, and a lot of people had never heard of. One of them is Aretha B. McKinley. She's a fascinating character, and she was, in fact, a lobbyist on Capitol Hill. This is in the 1960s, and she was the director of the American Council on Human Rights, a black woman, a woman who had an enormous impact on the movement. She was in the halls of power on a daily basis. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yes. And so to your point, Aretha McKinley was a lobbyist living in D.C. And in fact, I will say that I had no knowledge of her until I started doing research for this book. And so it really speaks to how these women's stories are often overshadowed, but so significant. One of the things that I emphasize in the book is that Aretha McKinley was someone who was very much at the center of conversations concerning civil rights, which is to say that part of her lobbying efforts in the early 1960s was in making sure that she was arguing for expanded voting rights. We can see the connections between her struggle and her efforts to the work that Fannie Lou Hamer was doing, for example, in the state of Mississippi and in other parts of the country. But the reason that I center McKinley's story is exactly to your point, that it wasn't simply about trying to advance civil rights, but she was committed to the dual mission, the recognition that she couldn't just lobby for expanded voting rights, for example, without drawing attention to the plight of black people in other parts of the globe. She was thinking about the way that black people were facing a number of challenges outside of the context of the United States, and how those challenges were in fact deeply intertwined with the national struggle. And so she would travel across the U.S. to essentially make that case. She would tell people, those who are deeply committed to the civil rights movement, that they also needed to think about what was happening in the Caribbean, as an example. They needed to think about what was happening in Latin America. They needed to think about what was happening on the African continent. It was a way to, I think, remind people that we cannot be involved in these struggles in isolation. We cannot imagine that the struggles we're facing in our own context are somehow disconnected from what's happening elsewhere. And she was someone who spoke about this, wrote about this, traveled extensively to make this case. And I really capture her story in the book in order to show that even in the context of the 60s, where the story is about the marches, certainly Martin Luther King Jr., Rosa Parks, all of these very important figures, that here you have a woman who's saying, actually, we need to be concerned with rights at multiple levels, and we need to be thinking globally.
The other piece of rhetorical, flourish that people used was equal rights.
Yes.
So we've got civil rights, human rights, mm-hmm. equal rights. And McKinley and others, distance themselves from the notion of equal rights. Why is that?
Well, I think for some activists, and this is true certainly for McKinley, there was a sense of worry that certain people saw the struggle, that certain people saw this movement on a national scale as simply Black people just wanting what white people had, or just wanting to be white, to frame it that way. And clearly that's not what the civil rights movement was about, but there were certain people, I think, who tried to disparage the movement by framing it as such. And I think McKinley wanted to show that it's not that. It's not a question of necessarily Black people wanting to have what white people have. No, it's simply recognizing that there are certain rights and there are certain protections that every person should have, whether they are white, whether they are Black, regardless of their racial background, their economic status, their educational background. None of these things should ultimately matter when it comes to this question of human rights and humanity and human dignity. And I think that was what McKinley and others tried to do. So to distance themselves from the framework of simply equal rights was, I think, a very strategic device, if you will, as a way to get people to grapple with the concerns, I think, at a deeper level. And it was a question of human dignity, ultimately.
And the organization she led, the ACHR, the American Council on Human Rights, she came to lead that organization in 1959, but it had been in existence for 20-something years. And it grew out of a Black women's sorority, Alpha Kappa Alpha, a.k.a. So there is a direct lineage between the sorority community and this myriad of organizations that you talk about in the 19th and 20th centuries. There are just a thousand titles of groups that got together and formed, some of them interracial, some of them solely African-American. Mm-hmm. But talk about the connection between the sorority community and some of these human rights organizations.
Yes, one of the things that I emphasize in the book is that Black women were really organizing at the grassroots level. They were thinking about human rights, and they were doing so decades before the more recognizable organizations and institutions like the United Nations and Amnesty International, as just two more modern day examples, and why it's so important to focus on sororities as just one of the many groups that I highlight here is that I'm essentially showing that these women were at the forefront of human rights activism, and they were doing that work in all of these spaces that were not necessarily human rights organizations, which is to say that you didn't necessarily need to see a human rights organization established in the 1930s to understand that Black women were deeply involved and invested in this work. And they were doing it through sororities, and they were doing it through their churches, and they were doing it through Black women's clubs. They were doing it through a range of organizations, some that we know of and others that are lesser known. And I intentionally weave in all of these groups because I'm trying to show that it's not just the individual impulse. It's not just the individual thinking about human rights, writing about these concerns, grappling with these concerns, but it's also the way that individuals connected with other like-minded people in these group settings to essentially attempt to move the conversation forward and to effect change from the ground up. It really is a remarkable story, and you see how sororities provide the space for Black women to do this kind of work when they don't have access to other spaces, when they are shut out of these more traditional spaces in terms of halls of power that we certainly talk about. And again, they're doing this at a moment where they don't even have full access to the vote.
Yeah, and you talk a lot about it right from at the top of the book. You talk about the barriers that they face, not only the fact that they were, you know, shut out because of they were African Americans, but mm-hmm. they were women.
Yes.
So they had even, you know, Black men in the community, you know, giving them a hard time as well. You also say that they bore witness to the worst of American racism and sexism during many of the historical moments when the United States presented to the world an image of progress and
yes.
equality. So the dichotomy between the image of the world that the U.S. tried to project internationally and the reality at home was something that they picked up on right away.
Yes, and it's one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book to center Black women, because I just thought it would be important to have a glimpse into how this group, marginalized group, how they effectively made human rights theirs, how they took this concept that clearly from the very beginning, I talk about how these ideas did not necessarily include Black people, that the philosophers, the European philosophers and thinkers who even articulated these ideas did not include in their vision people of African descent. And so part of it, I think, for these women was the importance of stepping in, taking this concept and saying, you may not think it applies to us, but actually it does. And you may be imagining that you could talk about human rights and exclude Black women. We're just not going to let you do that. And they center their experiences. And in so doing, they're able to show the hypocrisy of it all. They're able to show the hypocrisy of people saying they're interested in human rights and they're committed to it, but they don't want Black women's voices, or they don't want Black women in the room. And so it truly is a powerful story about people at the bottom, marginalized, effectively pushing their way forward and utilizing a range of strategies to make sure their voices are heard.
Yeah, pushing their way forward and being effective in the
Correct.
Meantime. Yeah, fantastic. Dr. Keisha Blaine, we're talking about her latest book, Without Fear, Black Women and the Making of Human Rights. We'll have more with Dr. Blaine on the other side of a quick break. We'll have her read a little bit from this really remarkable book. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, are property taxes in Maryland calculated fairly and accurately? Coalition of Taxpayers says that the process is flawed and that the state may be underassessing vacant land by as much as $500 million, leaving businesses and homeowners to subsidize land speculators. So we'll talk about the data and the demands of a group called the Fair Assessment Coalition tomorrow here on Midday. And if you've just joined us today, my guest is Dr. Keisha Blaine. She teaches history and Africana studies at Brown University, and she serves as the editor of Global Black Thought, a journal devoted to the work of Black intellectuals in the U.S. and throughout the African diaspora. She's the author or editor of 8 books, the latest of which we're talking about today. It's called Without Fear, Black Women and the Making of Human Rights. Dr. Blaine will be speaking about the book tonight at the Enoch Pratt Library. She'll be in conversation with the acclaimed historian Dr. Martha Jones of Johns Hopkins University. You are welcome to join our conversation today on Midday. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org. So, Dr. Blaine, let me ask you to read a little bit from the introduction to the book to give folks a flavor of what you're after here.
Without Fear offers a window into the everyday application of human rights among an often overshadowed group of activists and intellectuals in the United States. In standard and mainstream accounts, the history of human rights is told primarily through the ideas of white men, European philosophers and thinkers such as Friedrich Nietzsche and Ernst Troeltz, and organizations such as the United Nations and Amnesty International. These individuals and institutions have fundamentally shaped human rights history. Research, however, reveals a wide array of activists and leaders from all walks of life who contributed to this long-term project. Without Fear highlights an overlooked group in the development of human rights as a force for change. Centering Black women in the United States is not meant to place them above others in a comprehensive history of human rights. Indeed, a diverse constellation of historical actors in various locales, especially in the Global South, have contributed much to our understanding of human rights as idea and as praxis. My goal in highlighting Black American women is to illuminate how a historically marginalized group effectively made human rights theirs, moving beyond an esoteric concept to an organizing principle that fueled local, national, and global activism. The women who take center stage in this book, some eminent and notable and others who worked in relative obscurity for all their lives, labored to redefine the rights and dignity of all people, and they did so in the words of African-American educator Mary McLeod Bethune, without fear and hesitancy.
That's Dr. Keisha Blaine reading from her new book, Without Fear, Black Women in the Making of Human Rights, because this really is a compendium of profiles of people from the mid-19th century through the present day. I want to talk about one of them. I mentioned before the break the myriad of organizations that you allude to in the book, because these were organized efforts. These were not people doing sort of singular things. They're not writing op-eds in newspapers. They were really getting together. So there was the ILDP, the International League of Darker People, which and had, you know, African Americans from the United States teaming up with people from Japan and Indonesia and all, you know, all people from around the world. The Universal Negro Improvement Association, the International Council of Women of the Darker Races, all these different groups. One of them, a very international character herself, a very successful entrepreneur and businesswoman, Madam C.J. Walker. She had an interest in global affairs long before the International League of Darker People was even formed. But talk about her, how she impacted things not only happening here in the United States, but around the world.
Yes, Madam C.J. Walker is someone who I wanted to highlight in this book because she's so well known, and she's well known especially because of her wealth in terms of her entrepreneurship, her hair business. One of the things that scholars talk about is the fact that in the early 20th century, she traveled across the globe. And it's mostly as a way to talk about the way that she was exploring new markets, essentially, for her hair products. But in the book,
and she's known kind of as the first Black millionaire.
Yes,
right? She had millions of dollars in the early 1900s.
Yeah. Absolutely. She's often described as the first self-made Black woman millionaire. I think it's so then remarkable to talk about her as a human rights activist, essentially, because I think that particular aspect of her life story has not been emphasized as much as other aspects of her life. And one of the things that I talk about is how she is traveling. And it is true, she is exploring new markets for her hair products, but she's doing much more. So, for example, in 1913, she travels to Haiti. It's part of a trip in which she is talking about her company. But while she's in Haiti, she's meeting with Haitian leaders. She's mingling with members of the Haitian elite. She's certainly listening to them. She's talking to them about what's happening in Haiti at the time. And then she also decides to visit local prisons. And I really focus there because I think it's so powerful to just imagine what it must have meant, I think, for prisoners, many political prisoners at the time, receiving a visit, a surprise visit from this prominent Black woman from the United States. And while she's there, she's talking to them about the challenges that they're facing. Many of them had been in prison simply because they were speaking out about the government. They were speaking out about just a number of challenges in terms of inequality, the mistreatment of locals. And Madam C.J. Walker decided that she would talk about not only the plight of political prisoners, but also the condition of the prisons. And she spoke about it. She wrote about it in the aftermath of her visit to Haiti. She tried to raise global awareness of the challenges that Haitians were facing. And when the U.S. Occupied Haiti, she also joined a chorus of voices condemning the development. And so I talk about her as not simply someone who's doing remarkable things in terms of entrepreneurship and hair, but as someone who uses her influence and certainly her money. There, I discuss moments where she's using her own personal funds as a way to support a number of efforts to call attention to just the challenges that Black people are facing in different contexts.
Let's talk about another organization, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the WILPF. Again, there's scores of these things that have been put together at various times. And Mary Church Terrell, mm-hmm. One of the first African-American women in the United States to earn a college degree, a very prominent and important civil rights activist. She was a delegate to yes. the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom at one of their meetings. What is her significance and how did she move the ball?
Yeah, she's such a significant figure in so many ways, and she has a very storied career, lives a long life, and is involved in an array of organizations. One of the things that I highlight in this book is this powerful speech that she gives in 1919. She travels to Zurich in Switzerland, and she gives this speech in which she's talking about rights. She's talking about human rights. She's talking about the protections that should be given to all people, regardless of where they're located, regardless of their race, regardless of their socioeconomic background. And one of the things that stands out to me as I was reading her words and really putting the book together was how the ideas that she espoused in 1919 really, in so many ways, set the foundation for what would follow in 1948 with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is to say that we spend so much time talking about, of course, the UN, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Those are important developments. But what I show in the book is that, well, Black women such as Terrell, they were thinking about these ideas. They were articulating they were making these demands, and they were doing so decades before these later developments. And yet, their stories are not as well known. So I'm really pushing readers to grapple with what it means to be part of the conversation, to help shape the vision, and yet to be left out of the history.
Some people are known to the public and to history for activities outside of the civil rights movement. When we think about Dr. King and that movement, I mean, a lot of people do, you know, associate Harry Belafonte, for example, mm-hmm. with that movement. A very successful crossover artist who was, popular with white audiences as well as Black audiences. Another one who you talk about here is perhaps less known for her activism, but could be, and that's Lena Horne.
Yes.
She gave a speech in 1947 to a meeting of a group called the Progressive Citizens of America.
Mm-hmm.
Who were they? And what is Lena Horne's importance to the movement?
Yes, and so this is in the context immediately following World War II, a group of activists who are really coming together, thinking about the future, certainly the future of the nation, the future of the world. They are concerned about peace and security, as many people are in the context of World War II and its end. And Lena Horne is an interesting figure because, to your point, most people only know her in a very specific context in terms of her performance, in terms of her acting and as an entertainer. But I wanted to focus on her ideas on human rights, and I was able to get to that and really through her speeches, but also through her writings. I was surprised to learn that Lena Horne had a column, a very, I think, powerful column. In the 1940s into the 50s, she would write extensively about these issues. She would talk about her experiences traveling abroad. She would draw connections between what she saw in the UK, for example, and what she would experience in D.C. In a very similar way that Ida B. Wells called out the United States in the context of the late 19th century, Lena Horne was doing similar things. She was saying, look at how the U.S. are treating Black people. Black people can't even, find a cab when they're traveling to D.C. How does this make sense in a context in which the nation, the world, leaders of the U.S. have the nerve to say that they are, in fact, trying to make the world safe for democracy, or they're trying to be leaders in this broader vision for both democracy and liberty. And she's saying this doesn't add up when you take a look at what Black people are dealing with, as they're unable to even find equal housing opportunities or quality health care. And so she's drawing attention to that in her column. And so the book, I think, gives a window into Lena Horne's contributions to these conversations, moving beyond her acting and her contributions as an entertainer, but more so grappling with her as a human rights activist and an intellectual who's thinking deeply about what Black people are dealing with, certainly in the national context, but also drawing connections to what's happening globally.
Yeah, and I was certainly surprised to learn she had a column. I mean, I had no idea. I just always thought of her as number one of the most beautiful women in the world, and number two as an incredible entertainer, a singer, an actor. But her activism was, clearly, as you chronicle in this book, clearly very important. The book is called Without Fear: Black Women in the Making of Human Rights. Keisha Blaine is the author. We're talking here on Midday. Before we take a break, there were journalists involved in the movement. Perhaps the real godmother of all journalism is Ida B. Wells, who is impressive in that she figured out a way of getting into the halls of power. When she wrote about lynching, it wasn't that she was just writing it into the air of the newspaper she published in, but she got into the White House and talked to the President of the United States about this horrible, horrible epidemic and problem. She figured out a way of moving the levers of power in her writing. Talk a little bit about Ida B. Wells.
Yes, Ida B. Wells is such an extraordinary figure. I opened chapter one with her writings about lynching, and to your point, I also talk about a meeting that she has with President William McKinley. This is the late 19th century, and at the time, she is certainly making a case that Black people should be protected. She's saying the federal government has a responsibility to protect Black people against acts of violence. That's certainly an argument that she's emphasizing, but she takes a step further. And what she tells McKinley and what she writes about at the time is the fact that it's not solely that Black people are facing mistreatment and having to deal with violence, and it's and these experiences are violations in terms of the civil rights discussion and the protections that are owed to citizens. But she also says this is, in fact, the evidence of human rights abuses. This is the way she frames it. She lays this out to McKinley, and she's drawing connections between what's happening in the U.S. and what's happening in Cuba. She's also saying that the acts of lynching that Black people are having to endure are no different than massacres that are taking place in other parts of the globe. She's talking about the Armenian genocide at one point and drawing actual connections to the plight of Black people in the U.S. And I think that part of the narrative is so important. And it's her way to try to convince McKinley and others that change needs to happen. And it's not just for the sake of the United States living up to its promises and what it purports to be for American citizens, but it's also imperative for the United States to make a change because it ultimately shows the U.S. as weak in the eyes of its competitors on a global scale. And she certainly makes a passionate argument. She travels throughout the UK to push these ideas. As I explain in the book, her words do fall on deaf ears, but in many ways they lay the groundwork on which many women are able to build on in the years to follow.
Yeah, and again, this dichotomy between the image projected abroad in the years, you know, before the First World War, after the First World War, during the Second World War, at the same time that, you know, mm-hmm. lynching and, you know, the beacon of freedom that the United States was trying to be internationally did not shine for people of color in our country here at home. The book is called Without Fear, Black Women and the Making of Human Rights. The author is my guest, Dr. Keisha Blaine of Brown University. We'll have more with Dr. Blaine when we come back after a quick break. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, your local NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Dr. Keisha Blaine. She's an acclaimed historian in the History and Africana Studies departments at Brown University, and we're talking about her latest book, Without Fear, Black Women and the Making of Human Rights. You're welcome to join us, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. So I wanted to ask your take, Dr. Blaine, on the current status of human rights. You make the point, for example, we were talking about Lena Horne when she gave her speech in 1947 and was writing those columns. In 1948, we had the UNESCO experts from around the world crafted a statement on the race-based so-called scientific research. Mm-hmm. They issued a statement, there's no proof that the groups of mankind differ in their innate mental characteristics, whether in respect to intelligence or temperament. This is at a time when people were trying to prove, you know, scientific differences right. between black people and other people. But I wonder, you know, given the moment we're in now, one of the first acts of President Trump when he was elected last January was to rescind an executive order from 1965 that Lyndon Johnson had put in place to help enforce the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act of 64 and 65. There is an outright attack on DEI. They are making the case that diversity in the workplace, equity in the classroom, inclusion in federal agencies is a bad thing, that it is an exemplar of reverse racism. It's race-based, therefore it is evil, and they are doing their best to wipe it off the face of the earth. What do we take from the lessons of the people who organized in the late 19th century and all through the 20th century, and how do you see the current moment when it comes to civil rights, human rights, and dare I say it, equal rights?
Yes. Well, there's so much to say here. I think one of the things that come through the book, which I find so inspiring, is the way that black women in different contexts, in different locations, and essentially across time and space, push, and they passionately do so, push for human rights, utilizing a range of strategies and tactics. And even when they face roadblocks, another generation picks up the mantle and they keep going and they keep going until they see things begin to change. And things certainly do change. I think that's captured in the book. And there are certain gains in terms of the law. We think about human rights law as just an example. And I think when we're grappling with what's happening in this moment, it does remind us that the struggle continues. I think one of the dangers of the kind of the way we've celebrated, for example, the civil rights movement in this country, has been to give many people a false sense that we've accomplished everything we need to accomplish. We can now move on. We can move past it. We don't necessarily have to be involved in these efforts in the way we might have had to do so in the past. I think the developments of this moment are really should be a wake-up call for every single person to recognize that even the things we have accomplished, we can easily lose them. And we are losing many, many of the things we've accomplished, especially to your point, when we think about the Voting Rights Act is just one example, and the ways that there are constant efforts to chip away at these protections that so many fought for. And so I think the larger lesson here is that human rights broadly are not permanent, which is to say that we have to keep fighting for these rights. We cannot take a backseat. We cannot imagine that somehow this moment will pass over, will be fine. We do have to continue pushing in the same way that these women kept pushing. And I also reflect on even the title of the book, which, as I mentioned earlier, comes from Mary McLeod Bethune. This was coming out of a speech in 1944 in which she was talking to Black women at a workshop, and she's saying to them, we can do this work. We have to do this work. It's important for us to be deeply committed to human rights advocacy, and we have to do it without fear and hesitancy. Imagine in 1944, there were so many reasons for Black women to be afraid. So it's not simply to dismiss the feelings of fear, but it's to say that we can't allow the fear to guide our actions. We do have to push beyond it because the work is simply too important.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, who won a Pulitzer Prize when she was with the New York Times for the 1619 Project. She's now on the faculty of Howard University and writing magazine pieces and stuff. She gave an interview to the New York Times just a couple of days ago in which she makes the point, and others have as well, that the Trump administration often conflates civil rights and DEI as if they're the same thing. They're not, of course, but this effort to rid federal agencies and everybody else of DEI initiatives and any concentration on diversifying the workforce or the student body, et cetera, is seen by many in the MAGA movement as a civil rights issue. How do we help them untangle that?
Well, it's one of the reasons that I wrote this book. I am a firm believer that knowledge is power. And I recognize that many of the ideas that many hold, especially around DEI and those who are very resistant to it, comes out of a lack of full knowledge and understanding of the history. I'll say that. And I think it's important to ensure that these kinds of stories really do make it into the hands of as many people as possible. I think anyone who imagines that it's not important to grapple with race simply do not understand the history of the United States and simply do not have a nuanced perspective, simply don't understand what Black people have had to endure in this country. And I think it matters to read these histories. It matters to understand the context in which we're living. Everything that is taking place in this contemporary moment, they simply don't happen in isolation. I think they are very much linked to developments of the past. And so that's why I'm committed to telling these stories. And I think if those who are open, at least, I'm certainly willing to have those conversations. And I believe that it's important to keep pushing these narratives in order to counter the constant, I think, a barrage of misinformation that's circulating across the country.
Again, the book is Without Fear, Black Women and the Making of Human Rights, the author, my guest, Dr. Keisha Blaine. And it's interesting that you mention a misunderstanding or just a lack of connection to the history. You write about a woman named Kadi Diallo, mm-hmm. who is the mother of Amadou Diallo, who came to prominence in the public imagination when he was killed by police officers in New York City some years ago. And you write about how Amadou's mother, Kadi, had a difficult time figuring out her place in the movement for civil and human rights. She's quoted as saying the anger expressed by people at rallies for Amadou, her son, was built on a history that I didn't have and yes. could not know, no more than they could know the specific terror of hiding in a pit, thinking that soldiers with guns and machetes were on the way. She was not born in the United States. Right. She came from Haiti, I guess, right?
From Guinea.
Or Guinea.
Yes.
And so, you know, that the history is complicated and people's connection to that history is complicated.
It is. But that's why it's so important, I think, when I mentioned just this point that knowledge is power. And so to the example of Kadi Diallo, one of the things that really moved me as I was writing about her is the point that she recognized that she didn't fully understand the context initially. She had come to the United States in 1999 following the brutal and tragic killing of her son. And she was very interested in being part of the movement to bring an end to police violence and brutality in New York City. But as many activists on the ground told her, she needed to understand the longer history. She needed to know not just what was happening in New York, but what was happening across the country. And I think, to her credit, she was open to learning. She was open to listening, to figuring out her own place in the movement and the way that she would be able to contribute. I think that's an aspect of political organizing that needs to be highlighted a lot more. There's a sense in which sometimes, you know, we want to just jump into the fray. We want to, and perhaps well-meaning, we want to participate in an effort to effect change, and we should be willing to do so. But there are times where the first step is, in fact, simply learning the community, learning the challenges of the community, understanding the historical context. How did we get to this moment? How did we find ourselves here? And how do we then move forward? And I think, to Kadi's credit, she took the time to learn. She took the time to learn the history. It didn't mean that she agreed with everything, or, you know, but she took the time to learn the history. And once she learned it, she could then bring her own ideas to the table with a full sense of what was happening in New York. And then she was able to team up with someone like Al Sharpton, collaborate with him for a moment in order to bring attention to not just her son's killing, but to a pattern of state-sanctioned violence that was certainly taking place in the 1990s and into the 2000s.
Dr. Keisha Blaine, her new book is Without Fear, Black Women and the Making of Human Rights. Dr. Blaine will be speaking about the book tonight at 7 o'clock at the Enoch Pratt Central Library here in Baltimore. She'll be in conversation with another acclaimed historian, Dr. Martha Jones of Johns Hopkins University, and that event begins at 7 o'clock. Well, Dr. Blaine, thanks for this nice conversation about a very important book. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And give my best to Dr. Jones tonight at the Pratt Library. She's been on the show about some terrific books that she's written as well.
Wonderful. I will. I certainly will.
Well, best wishes to you both. And that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation about fairness in the process of property tax assessments. I'll speak with Bob Yeager. He's the head of the Maryland Department of Assessments and Taxation, Greg Miller of the Center for Land Economics, and a few of my colleagues from our news partner, the Baltimore Banner, who have been covering this issue. That's on the way tomorrow. And up next now, it's Fresh Air, a conversation with Zanny Mitten-Bedos, who's the editor-in-chief of The Economist. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for being with us. I am grateful. Have a great day.